RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for this week's Health Hacks, Monday morning here at RCR. Joining us from the US, Dr. Anna Goodwin, retired oncologist, fellow of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians, fellow of the Royal Australian College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, fellow of the Australasian Society of Lifestyle Medicine, a New Zealand natural health practitioner. She's out of the country right now, but that won't stop us. So this week's Health Hacks is about brain cancer. Dr. Anna Goodwin, welcome back to our Health Hacks. Great to be able to talk with you again.
Thank you, Paul, for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
I think it was around September last year that we last chatted.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I always kind of take a review of the status of oncology and cancer before I get on here with you in case there's been any major breakthroughs. And the thing that kind of got me a little bit stressed was the projections of the WHO that we're going to have a 77% relative incidence of cancer in the global population by 2050. And they really didn't offer any explanation except for the fact that we're getting more sedentary and we have pollution in our air, water, and food that's largely provided by corporate operatives that are affiliated with the WHO. So
yeah,
they can
curious, isn't
these
it?
Things because they're actually causing a lot of these things, but it's going on so far above our heads that we don't think about it much. But it really comes down to involvement of the population at a grassroots level in their public policy, because these things actually do matter. We can't just be business as usual. And unless we want to actually fulfill that rather grim prophecy, we have to start taking matters into our own hands. And unfortunately, I've been the doctor that's been at the bottom of the cliff for much of my career, and I'm trying to climb my way back up the cliff and keep people from falling over it. And so one of the things that I got interested in the last few years, because I was the doctor who saw many patients who had failed their primary treatment for brain cancer. And so the most dreaded form of brain cancer is actually glioblastoma multiforme. We call it GBM for short because no one wants to say that very often. But I started looking for, number one, ways that we could prevent it and possibly understand it better, and ways that we could sort of help people live with it longer and better. And, you know, I did a very humble little study back in around 2016 on a series of about 20 patients that came over to see me after they'd already had their surgery, their radiation, and their chemotherapy. And those patients in general had a survival of about 3 months if left with no further treatment, much less. And the overall survival, even with this combination of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, was about 14 months. That's called the Stuff protocol, which has been around for almost 20 years now. And unfortunately, we haven't moved the meter very much on those results. So I've been really, really gratified to sort of to follow some of the work of Matt Phillips at Waikato and some of the work in Christchurch. And some of the New Zealand researchers have really sort of been punching above their weight on this whole field in understanding the metabolism. And you've been very good to have those of us who are interested in metabolic therapies discuss this regularly on your show. And as we've discussed many times, it comes down to metabolism and mitochondrial function. And in that respect, I think that brain cancer is not much different than many other cancers.
Anna, I've known two people just in the last 6 months, two very close to me, who have died of brain cancer. It's like it came out of nowhere. Now, I don't know if that's a statistical blip or there's more of it or whatever. And they didn't last very long at all. And they were, before that, very healthy, vibrant people. It kind of rocked me, I've got to say.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Paul. And you know, I did try to make an effort to see what the latest statistics are for New Zealand, but not unsurprisingly, there have been no statistical reports from Stats New Zealand since about 2019 to the 2020. And you know, there are a number of international reports suggesting that the cancer rate in general is going up. And like yourself, I'm seeing not only a bit more brain cancer, but I'm seeing a greater increase in certain mutations that I wasn't seeing before. Prior to the last year, I was not actually seeing much in the way of BRAF positive cancers. BRAF is a gain of function gene that is present in some cancers, and there are some, you know, coincidentally, some pharmaceutical agents that have recently been developed that go after that mutation. And as many things are happening, we're seeing also some knockout of certain genes that certain pharmaceutical agents can fix. And there's a whole lot of things going on with our food, our drugs, and you know, we all sense that there's something rather sinister afoot with some of these things without invoking conspiracies. Yeah. But I would not be alone in raising some concerns about the fact that the ways and the means of changing human genome does exist right now through the CRISPR technology. And you know, it seems rather strange that we're seeing so much, and there's just not any documentation. So of course that raises concerns in the general populace, and in certainly anyone that's kind of paying attention would be a little bit concerned that there's not a bit more forthrightness in how this information is being conveyed. And is there manipulation of data? And there's been a great deal of controversy as well over whether cell phones are linked to brain cancer.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, totally.
The IARC acknowledged in 2011 that there was a probable link between cell phone use and the development of brain cancer, but it just... There were no, it said more study is needed, and naturally, because no one wants to know, because the telecommunications industry is even more powerful than the oil industry now, no one wants to actually determine this. And I think overall, there's no need to cause mass hysteria, but I think it's probably, you know, and a Swedish study actually documented in people that use cell phones starting before the age of 20 do have a fourfold greater risk of developing a brain tumor on the same side if they hold their phone. And, you know, maybe coincidence, maybe not, but most of the tumors that I'm seeing are on the right side, either in the parietal or temporal lobe of the brain. So, you know, is that a coincidence, or is it just that 85% of the population is right-handed? Don't know. But a lot of these things are just sort of being ignored. But you have 7 billion people in the world using cell phones. So I think overall, the risk is probably relatively low, but cumulative. And so when we start looking at other risk factors, perhaps, you know, that can be linked back to diet, toxin exposure, you know, did you grow up in a fluoridated water area? These are all cofactors that could potentially have an additive effect. I don't believe cancer is really just one thing. I think it's a cumulative effect that causes a stepwise, you know, de-differentiation of a particular cell that leads then to the malignant clone that then grows and, you know, doesn't get turned off because it's actually still getting the inflammatory signals. So, you know, in the paradigm that we've discussed before, you know, it often occurs from an inciting injury in the presence of a lot of inflammation or other toxins, and with inadequate nutrition to actually overcome the mutational burden. In particular, one of the things that I think is particularly relevant is B12 and methylation donors. We see a real deficiency in B12 levels across the Western world, and that's a multifactorial problem. But I've observed, even in some of my brain tumor patients that were getting the standard chemotherapy, when we actually treat those who have a methylation problem with B12, I was seeing similar results across the boards to those that would have a better prognosis because they had proper methylation function in some of their enzymes. So I've just started incorporating B12 in most of my patients in that setting. So it's very interesting. There's a lot of things going on, and hopefully we can start getting a greater understanding of the causation, because until we acknowledge some association or causation or something that can be mitigated, it's very hard to entertain thoughts about prevention. And one of the things that's important to know is that people that have had a prior concussion, in my little study, which was only about 18 patients, the ratio of men to women was 2-1, and I thought that was rather strange. And then I started questioning the men about contact sports and concussions. And indeed, most of the men had had at least 2 concussions and had played rugby, and that didn't cause a cancer straight up, but you know, it created a knock, perhaps a little change in the gene in that particular area of the brain. And then you throw in, you know, a lifetime of toxin exposures and EMF exposures and whatever other toxins or nutritional deficits were present. And then, you know, I think this is why we see such variations in why cancer manifests in some people and not in others. It seems really unfair, but
it does. It is.
I think this is why we see that difference, and it's not just a 1-to-1 relationship. And that's how the tobacco industry sort of avoided any culpability for their products for so long, because they could point at the fact that not everybody that smokes gets cancer.
Yeah, no. How do you know you've got a brain tumor? I know it's kind of a really basic question, but I'm sort of curious as to what are the onset of symptoms of that usually?
Well, it's a very important question, Paul. Usually it can just be a subtle headache or a headache that doesn't go away. I'm much more concerned about a headache that starts in the morning, especially a new onset of headaches is very important in someone in their 40s or 50s or even younger. I have seen a young woman who was under age 30 recently, which was very distressing for me. Headaches, behavioral changes, cognitive changes, or it kind of depends on what side of the brain we're dealing with. For left-sided cancers, there's oftentimes an impact on speech. So people will begin slurring their speech or mispronouncing words or being unable to speak. And that's a particularly distressing thing. The reason this is such a bad tumor is that it not only can be fatal, it also causes all the miseries of a stroke, and it depends on which side of the brain is actually involved in the tumor. So left-sided cancers, because they affect speech, oftentimes are noticed beforehand because family becomes quite alarmed, gets the person into the doctor. Most people don't use the right side of their brain, or they're not aware that they're using it as much as the left side. So it can often cause subtle behavioral changes that might go unnoticed. And importantly, sometimes the first heralding factor can simply be a seizure. I've had several patients just, you know, have a seizure, and then they come to medical attention, and that leads to their diagnosis. Yeah, it's kind of a drag.
Yeah, it's the worst place, you know, just thinking about it, it's the worst place in the body, kind of. That's what it feels like anyway to me, the worst place. And I've had cancer before. I had it on the tongue and in the throat, and that wasn't that pleasant, but I got over it. But, you know, there's something about the brain. It's sort of kind of hidden away, and we know it's that sort of vital vital piece of our anatomy, isn't it, that, yeah, where everything kind of happens.
It's what makes us ourselves, and it is, you know, people feel that they're literally losing themselves, or their caregiver feels like they're losing the person they love, and it is quite devastating, and it's unlike Alzheimer's, that gives people a little bit of time to say goodbye. This oftentimes comes on rather suddenly and just gets worse, and the caregiver burden is recognized to be among the highest of all cancers. And, you know, there is support with the New Zealand Brain Tumor Support website. They have resources there which may be helpful for some people. And I think they're a great organization, and if any of your listeners are able to give them a little money, that would certainly be great. I don't have any ties to them per se, but I just think they do good work. And yeah, it is one of the more compelling cancers that I think we just really need improvement on. And that's why I've been excited to find that, you know, ketogenic diets can help. And as you rightly say, Paul, the brain is unique among organs, and it's also a unique place to have cancer, because we were designed to be able to function when we're hungry. So the brain actually does better when we're in a state of ketosis, which is actually quite interesting, because it helps us become smarter, so that when we're burning ketones, the brain actually functions better, so that we can find our next meal, because the body is starting to say, you know, we need some right. food here. So the brain does well on ketones. The brain can function at about half the oxygen level of the rest of the body, which is also quite interesting. So even if you're being suffocated, the brain is still hanging in there. And it has this thing called the blood-brain barrier, which seals out toxins and keeps the toxins from getting to the brain. So the brain is the last place oftentimes affected by a toxin, which has made it somewhat difficult to treat with chemotherapy and some modalities that are highly polar, because the brain is 85 to 90% lipids. And so getting something across that lipid layer when it's a highly polar molecule is oftentimes difficult. And sometimes that just doesn't happen as far as drug delivery goes. So this is why, you know, we've been a little bit stymied with developing drugs that actually can get into the brain and treat the cancer. So novel therapeutics are being developed, and things like that are coming down the pipeline. Peptide therapies are getting to be a thing, and those are in clinical trials in America. And there's a lot of growth signaling molecules that are also being developed. So I'm excited about the amount of research, but it does take, you know, clinical trials and time to get these implemented into the bedside to help the patients.
Is there any benefit, Anna, in, you know, going through the orthodox, I guess we call them now, cancer treatments? You mentioned chemo before. There's radiotherapy. And that's what sort of nuked my one, if I remember back 10 years ago now. Is there any point in pursuing those? Do they give you a bit longer? Or, you know, what do you do in this situation?
Patients that are drawn to me oftentimes are looking for something different, and they want to do the alternative to standard treatment. But I can say categorically, at least in my experience, as much as I'm a fan of natural products and, you know, would use chemotherapy and radiation very judiciously, I strongly advocate that people have standard treatment, because it does buy them time. And even though it's not pleasant, it's probably not as bad as the treatment that you went through, Paul. To be honest.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, well, I was in bed for 4.5 months after that. So.
So, you know, people on standard treatment could expect to have a little bit of fatigue, sometimes, and as I keep mentioning, the brain heals itself by sleep. So, you know, it's important to take a power nap, get up, do some walking or other exercise. And, you know, they'll give a low dose of chemotherapy that's usually not terribly nauseating. It's just a in pill form. They lose their hair, but oftentimes the hair will come back after the treatment's completed. And so it's basically just take some pills and you go through about 6 weeks of radiation therapy. And with that protocol, people are living median survival, which means people live longer and some people don't live quite so long. But people live about 14 or 15 months with that. I've had only one or two patients who have opted for no treatment, and they simply refused everything, and they lasted 3 to 5 months. So I think right now, knowing that there are other treatments out there, and there are other things coming down the pipe, to me, if someone can stay alive longer and, you know, have a few trade-offs and side effects and have, you know, about a year longer survival, it makes sense to do standard treatment. And I don't say that lightly, and I know it disappoints a lot of people that are in the integrative and complementary world, but it's just what the data suggests right now. It's you know, it's where the science is at the moment.
I noticed earlier you mentioned fluoride, and that got me thinking because there's, well, definitely here on RCR, very big debate on, in fact, almost a campaign to have it banned from water supplies, the mass medication. I haven't heard fluoride mentioned in relation to, well, brain cancer or cancer anyway. I was aware of IQ drop and studies done there. So is there anything that we need to know about that? Have you got any information that sort of adds to that debate?
Not really brain cancer per se, but when we look at the fact that it's not just the one thing. You can't point at fluoride and say this is a definite cause. But when we look at the fact that it's an inflammatory neurotoxin, and it reduces cognition, and people with brain cancer are going to be suffering with reduced cognition. It's one of those additive things that this patient population clearly does not need. And when we look at the important role of normal neurotransmitters like GABA, melatonin, serotonin, all of these things are altered. And, you know, the more we can create normalcy for the brain and let the brain heal, and it heals through restorative sleep, which is facilitated by melatonin, and then we aren't getting the melatonin levels that people should have because of the calcification of the pineal gland due to the fluoridated water, and that is documented. So that's been well established over the years. So it's probably affecting mental health in a very real way in fluoridated communities. We have a very stressed population in general, and I just don't see any benefit. It's been, I mean, you know, there's no rational basis for thinking that that little wash over your teeth when you swallow a glass of water is actually impacting your dental health. And we know that it's the fluoridation from the, you know, our brushing our teeth that actually affects the biofilms in the mouth and reduces the risk of decayed and missing teeth. So it's not actually fluoridation in the water. That's always been a false paradigm, and it just does nothing for human health. It actually detracts from human health, especially in vulnerable populations.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. That's why we do it, I suppose. Gosh. Boy. Oh, dear. Do people get cured?
The longest survivor I've found for brain cancer is a lady named Carmen Rice, who just celebrated 20 years of being free of her glioblastoma, and that's quite a milestone. She is the world's longest survivor, and I would assume that at 20 years she can truly be said to be cured. So there's always hope as long as someone's alive. New things are coming down the pike, and, you know, I think there's some very real benefit to, you know, changing one's metabolic frequency, embracing certain anti-inflammatory things in your diet, such as omega-3 fatty acids. Curcumin has been shown to actually protect the brain from radiation, the normal brain cells from chemo and radiation, while sensitizing the cancerous cells to chemo and radiation. So I really am very much a fan of curcumin and turmeric compounds in this space. Certainly vitamin D and K2 seem to be helpful for patients with IDH1 mutated tumors. I'm afraid to say this because oftentimes when something is helpful, it disappears from public access. There are compounds known as alpha-ketoglutarate and things like that that can actually help with correcting the metabolic defect in the cancer cells, and that's broadly available. This is why they keep coming after our therapeutic goods and our vitamins and supplements, because they don't actually want the drug industry to have any competition. That seems to be, that's not conspiracy. You can just
shut down the competition. I think we're well aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's not conspiracy theory. It's just fact.
Again, I'm referencing my own experience, nothing like this, but I had a lot of time to think about, you know, my problem, and especially after the treatment. And I kind of went into myself and tried to, sounds kind of, well, not nutty, but I tried to communicate directly, literally with the cells in my body. You know, I tried to sort of like order them to do a particular thing. And I couldn't put any, you know, description that had any sort of science behind it. But I was very concentrated on that. What I'm asking is your mental attitude, people, I suppose, they meditate, they do things like that. Is that part of it too, Anna?
Oh, I totally believe in that, Paul. I think you're really cottoned on to something. And the lady who was the longest survivor actually described her journey as being a miracle. And I think certainly prayer, meditation, getting theta waves, alpha waves, all the healing energies of the brain. And there's a guy that, I forget his name, but he wrote a beautiful book called Dialogue with My Cells. And he had a brain tumor.
That's actually, it. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And he actually was addressing his cells. And I think it's important to as with all cancers, to have the meditation around the cells being healed, not necessarily, you know, focusing on killing the cancer, but talking to your good cells and affirming the health of your body and affirming the health of your brain, your mind, all of your body, mind, and soul. We are a multidimensional being, and these things absolutely have ramifications on our body when we invoke higher energies and you know, some people call it God, some people call it the universe, but you know, in infusing your body with that knowledge and reminding yourselves of how they're supposed to work, I think is a very, very powerful thing. I would never diminish that. And I think, you know, it's one of the biggest ways of empowering people and helping them get through their fear. Because as long as people are frightened, and it's very difficult not to be frightened in this situation, as long as people are living in fear of death, fear of loss of function, and all the things that are attendant with this cancer, it's very, very hard for them to take dominion over that. And that's what, to me, in my own self, I think this would be one of the hardest cancers, because depending upon what function is impacted, you may or may not have the ability on some level. So you might have to rely on your caregiver and friends to actually, you know, read or speak these types of words and meditations over you if you're not able to come to terms with that yourself, as you were able to do in your situation, Paul.
Well, I found with me, and I'm not making this about me, but I do have an experience of going through that process.
We all love you, Paul, and what you contribute is very valuable in this space, because it's very valid.
Well, first-hand experience, the recovery after I started doing that accelerated. And the clinical people told me at the end of it, my last visit, that I was the best example of a recovery they'd ever seen.
I think that's fabulous. And it probably has much to do with your mental and spiritual.
I think it does. I do think it did. Yeah, I do.
And funnily enough, the medical field has even had the hubris to do a randomized trial of people who got prayed for after their surgery and people that did not get prayed for. And ironically enough, the prayer group, and it was an interdenominational prayer, the group that got prayed for actually got through with the hospital 2 days quicker and had a better recovery and fewer complications. And you know, there's no reason not to. It doesn't cost anything.
No.
And our brains are nothing if not a transmitter. You know, this is where telepathy comes in. Our brains are simply electronic conductors, and you know, they are impacted by frequencies, words, nutrition, chemistry, all manner of things. And I think however we can communicate with what to me seems like the last frontier of medicine, getting into the human brain and really all of its nuances, I think that's beautiful. It's absolutely a way forward, and certainly an excellent concurrent modality that doesn't add to the cost of care.
Coming up against time, Anna, so if people are afflicted with this horrible thing, how early, because this is the other thing, I mean, I caught mine just at the last time span of them being able to help me, as it turned out. So it was a close run thing, I was told. You know, I could feel something was wrong because of the particular part of the body it was in. In the brain, I don't think that would be so apparent as early on as it was maybe for me, even though I left it too long. Is it in the case of brain cancers, kind of when you know something's wrong, it's almost too late? Is that what happens?
Well, I think certainly the earlier something is found, the better. But presently, because this is a cancer that's quite different than all the other cancers in the body, the other cancers, we worry about them killing people through spreading to other organs and metastasizing and that sort of thing. This is a cancer that doesn't usually go anywhere. It basically manifests by changing the pressure in the brain. So what's the only manifestation that people often have, because the brain itself doesn't really have pain fibers, although it's where we sense and process pain elsewhere in the body. It's the lining of the brain that has pain fibers, and that's how we experience the headache. And once we're pushing from the brain outward onto the lining of the brain, you know, it's certainly not an early detection thing. And it's really just you know, pay attention to your symptoms. If you're having headaches and feeling a bit off color, don't go swimming in open water. I had a couple of people have seizures in the water, which is never a good thing.
No. And last question, because we're coming up against time. I don't mean to rush you, but time's always tight on this program now because we've got so much going on. Surgery. How successful can surgery be? Because I guess there's only so many places you can go in the brain surgically, are there?
Yeah, that's the reason for, you know, if we could detect it early, it means generally that you have a smaller surgery and less normal brain tissue is having to be impacted. And this is a cancer that, at least in my observation, it most commonly recurs right around the rim of the surgery. And that's an area that's sort of the watershed where you have the inflammation, all the post-surgical substances that are there to try to heal. And it's these things that are actually the drivers for the recurrence. And so, you know, each time they go back in, the surgery is a little bit less successful. And, you know, we seldom ever want, if someone's otherwise a healthy person, we almost always follow the surgery with the chemo and radiation to try to reduce the risk of relapse. it's oftentimes just almost inevitable. I'm very interested in the role of hyperbaric treatment, because seem to actually push the inflammation out of the area. And conversely, when people are at altitude, if they're on long-haul flights, and I have had a couple of patients, you know, that have relapsed after long-haul flights, because that itself causes a little bit of inflammation of the brain and pressure shifts that may not be in the best interest of the person with this disorder. So that's not usually discussed, and I know it's kind of like Dr. Killjoy with the love of Kiwis for travel, but I'm very cautious with my patients who are, who've achieved remission. I try to keep them from going on long-haul travel if I can, at least for a couple of years, I just as a matter of being cautious because of the pressure shifts. And it has been documented that these pressure shifts can impact, you know, the disease process in vitro. So it might be overkill, and some people don't want to hear that. So if it is something that resonates with someone and can help them, great. If it's too hard, I get that too.
Oncologist Dr. Anna Goodwin, nice to talk to you again. Some really interesting information there. Beaming in from, I think, somewhere in Alabama, is it?
Perhaps.
Sweet home?
Perhaps sweet home. Yeah. But coming back soon. So, Paul, thank you.
All right.
Thanks so much for having me. And blessings and peace to all of your listeners. Bye-bye for now.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.